Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history.
Welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast, everybody, and this an episode in our series on iconic ships. Now, if you haven't done so yet, do please head to our back catalogue and check out all of the other fabulous episodes we have recorded on history's most iconic ships. Most recently, we have published an episode on the SS United States, which I think is my new favourite ship. Launched in 1951, she still holds the blue ribbon record for the fastest crossing of the Atlantic in either direction. We've also published several episodes on the magnificent Lusitania and her terrible loss in the First World War, on Brunel's extraordinary ship, the Great Eastern, which includes a frankly astonishing video of a frankly astonishing ship model, a diorama held in the collections of the National Maritime Museum. We've done one on Shackleton's Endurance, recently discovered at the bottom of the Antarctic, on the Thermopylae, HMS Barham, the Ark Royal, HMS Victory, the list goes on and on. Today we're heading further back in time than we ever have before, than we've ever dared before, to a medieval iconic ship. We're here to find out about Henry V's ship, the Grâce Dieu, launched in 1418, and what a ship she was. Henry only reigned for 10 years, but in those years he worked harder than any of his predecessors to build a navy designed to destroy French sea power, such a threat during the Hundred Years' War. His ships were not just barges designed for transporting armies to France, but were great warships built for prestige and power. It's during Henry V's time as king that one of the finest medieval warships of them all, the Grâce Dieu, was built. Contemporary descriptions marvelled at her size, and modern historians were cynical about her size until the wreck in the River Hamble near Southampton was surveyed. These investigations proved that her mainmast was 200 feet tall. She was nearly three times larger than Henry VIII's Mary Rose, which was built nearly a century later. And no warship rivaled her for size for another 200 years. At the lowest of tides, you can still see the timbers of this wonderful ship poking out of the mud in the River Hamble. To find out more about this remarkable feat of construction and vision, I think is perhaps the most important word here, the vision to see and then attempt something apparently impossible. Well, I spoke with a legend in the world of medieval maritime history, the wonderful Susan Rose. Among her many books are England's Medieval Navy, 1066 to 1509, The Ship's Men and Warfare, The Wine Trade in Medieval Europe, 1000 to 1500, one of my favourite books, that one. Most recently, The Wealth of England, The Medieval Wool Trade and Its Political Importance, 1100 to 1600. Now, as ever, I hope you like listening to her as much as I enjoyed talking with her. Here is the brilliant Susan Rose. How do you start studying Henry V? Is he an easy person to study?
Well, I mean, it was all due to George Naish. Do you remember he was secretary of the Navy Record Society, and he was secretary of the SNR, I think, as well. And he was curator at Greenwich. And he's an extraordinary man. He's very tall and thin. And if you talk to him, he walked round and round you in circles.
Very disconcerting.
Anyway, I had graduated, and I was very bored with a baby. Mm. So New Statesman had an ad saying you could do postgraduate work at Birkbeck for £9 a year. So I wrote off. And I went to see someone called Alwyn Ruddock at Birkbeck, who was the reader in Tudor economic history, because I wanted to do something glamorous, you know, an Elizabethan glamour boy. Yeah. And she looked at me and said, if you've got a small baby, you better do an edition of a document. I think there's one at Greenwich.
Right.
So I went to Greenwich, and George produced this account book of the clerk of the King's ships, William Soper, in the 1420s. Mm-hmm. And I transcribed it by hand. I don't I ever do that now.
No. Amazing. How long did that take you?
Well, it actually took me about 3 years.
What?
Because I had two more children in the time. And I used to hide the bump under the seminar table at the IHR.
Oh, very good. Very good.
But anyway, and once you know you'd got the text, you had to look at the ships. And obviously the Grastio was the biggie.
Yeah. Let's just talk about the Grastio then. Why is it so important?
Well, I mean, first of all, it is just about as big as Victory.
Nelson's HMS Victory.
Nelson's Victory, yes. Okay. And when you consider it was clinker built, you know, the strakes overlapping, not edge to edge to edge, or the planks, you know. Yeah. It was probably the biggest clinker-built ship ever built.
Wow.
And it had a...
just for our listeners, we'll say that, you know, HMS Victory is 200 and something years after...
Yes.
...after the Grastio was built.
It had a very particular way of doing clinker-build, which... generally speaking, you know, have one like that and it overlaps, so you have one overlapping, you know. When you rent a rowing boat or something like that, they're very often clinker built.
Yep.
And some fiberglass dinghies pretend, you know, they have bumps along.
It's the classic look of a little dinghy.
Yes, that's right.
Or if you imagine a Viking boat.
A Viking boat. But the way the clinker building on the Grastio was done, it had at one point it was three layers thick.
Wow!
Because they had one, a middle one, and yeah, and so you had a great long nails. Bolts to go through three layers of planks, yeah. And with a rivet or a clench on the end. So. Technically, it was extraordinary.
Yeah. And nothing remotely like this size had been built before?
Nothing remotely like this size, because the biggest sailing ships at the time were in the Mediterranean, and Mediterranean shipbuilders after the classical period, used a carvel build.
Yeah. I mean, these are called Venetians and the Genoese.
The biggest sailing ships were those of the Genoese.
Oh, okay.
And they were in fact called carvels, and carvel building is the way their hulls were done, right. Edge to edge.
Okay, edge to edge. So a bit more advanced. And it allows you to build big and strong.
Yes. I mean, you with a carvel-built ship, it's frame first, and then you stick the sides on.
Yep.
With a clinker-built, you sort of build the sides on and then keep them out, you know, with putting in beams. Mm. And the problem probably with Grastio was that they'd reached the absolute limit of that technology. The strain between the beams and the sides must have been extraordinary.
What was Henry V up to? I mean, he must have... I,
Wish I would have been at that meeting where he'd got his shipwrights in and said, right, guys.
What he was up to is quite clear. I mean, the fact was, he was, you know, faced with the fact that the Genoese were allies of the French. And by the details of the treaty, they had agreed to supply the French with a fleet of carvels, i.e. these big clinker-built sailing ships. Mm-hmm. And if Henry V got the fleet to Agincourt across the channel without opposition, but after the victory at Agincourt, the next big engagement was the siege of Harfleur,
yeah,
which was the French naval base in effect. And the English had taken that, and it was under siege, and the Duke of Bedford put together the best fleet he could in the August of 1416 to relieve Harfleur, and fought in the mouth of the Seine a sea battle against the Genoese. And he managed, in fact, to capture four of the Genoese carvel built ships, and in fact a fifth one was driven onto the coast and wrecked. So he managed to take these ships with the forces he had. Now, leading his fleet were two of the king's pre-existing great ships, but these were not so enormous. I mean, there was the Jesus and the Trinity Royal were the two largest. There was another one called the Holy Ghost, which was a rebuilt Spanish ship. And so, you know, he could see that if he was going to be faced with more carvel or more Genoese fleets, he would have to have something that was bigger than the best Genoese carvel, because there were very rudimentary guns on these ships, but I reckon they were the main function was to cause alarm and despondency, because they were very likely to blow up, which of course wasn't a good idea, but they of course created heat and smoke and noise and that, but I don't think it did much damage to anybody, because they were mounted on the deck firing over the gunwales. I don't think they couldn't aim them, so
no. A demonstration of resources in
a yeah, I mean, they were very expensive, so you know, they and they say they clearly would make a great sort of row and smoke and all this kind of thing. I mean, apart from the Battle of the Seine, which Bedford won, there were one or two other incidents when royal Ballingers. Now, Ballingers were like sort of modified Viking ships with better sails and higher freeboard, but compared to a carvel, they were like gnats, you know, chasing a rat or something, you know.
Yeah.
And there is in one of the chronicles there's an account of how I think there's four or five Ballingers chased a carvel up the channel all day and tried to get boarding ladders on it, and in fact got alongside, got the boarding ladders up, and then of course they were thrown off the gunwales by the crew, and they ended up
hand fighting.
Yes, they could not board because they were so much lower in the water, the high sides. They had to climb up somehow, and the obvious. I mean, one of the tactical things to do was to build a ship that was either higher so you could jump down, or the same about level and you could get over the rails and that onto the deck.
Yeah.
So it was to deal with the threat posed by the Genoese sailing ships, caravels, carvels, not caravels, they're carvel-built ships, or they're also known as Carracks. Mm. So he, the orders were given to build the Grâce Dieu, and he also ordered a similar type of ship from Bayonne, which is, you know, in English, Gascony, which was never finished. Mm. So there was a...
It was supposed to be another one. Mm-hmm. There was supposed to be another one.
Yes. I mean, there was a policy decision. I mean, it always strikes me that it's very like the Vanguard in 1944.
Right.
You know, we'll have something bigger than the Tirpitz and, sure. I mean, the Scharnhorst, you know.
Yeah.
And, of course, when it was finished, the war was over. Well, the same thing happened more or less to the Grâce Dieu. The time it was afloat, Henry had won. And so what were they going to do with it? Well, the answer is they did try to use it. But I think it must have been extremely difficult to handle.
Yeah.
It had 3 masts.
And no one's had any experience of handling anything this big.
Nobody.
So it's not just difficult to handle. No one knows what they're doing.
Well, not quite no experience, because the captured Carracks were taken into the royal, well, you know, the English, the king's ships, and were crewed by, you only have to look at the Mary Rose, the results of all the bones on the Mary Rose to know that crews were very mixed. They weren't
international.
Yes, they were if you were told to go and crew the king's ship, you hadn't got much. You couldn't argue. You went.
So it's more rather than international. It's the nation of sailors.
Yeah, a nation exactly. I mean, you know, like there was one law of the sea, all the way up the Atlantic coast of France, round into the Channel, into the Baltic. There's a whole language of the sea, and the sailing directions and that were undoubtedly shared between. So, you know, they had sailed Carracks, but this ship was of an order larger than a Carrack. How much experience they had on managing a ship with 3 masts, I think, is a... I mean, the Carracks had 3 masts. But the mizzen sail, the one at the back, was a lateen, you know, three-cornered sail. And so that it would be handled differently from the others were square sails and would have bowlines at the corner, you know, so you could alter the angle of the sail by adjusting the bowlines and that kind of thing.
Do you know how many people would have been on the crew?
Oh, yes. You do know that because on the one occasion that the Grâce Dieu went to sea, when Henry V had won, or rather had driven the Genoese out of the Channel, and he was about... he was more or less in a position to negotiate the Treaty of Troyes with Charles VI. Mm-hmm. They had a regular system of summer patrols along the Channel to keep an eye on any enemy ships. I mean, intelligence was always very patchy, so sailing up and down, about best you could do. Well, in 1420, after the Grâce Dieu had been launched and was ready and equipped, it was included in one of these patrols, which was going to be led by the Earl of Devon, Hugh Courtenay, who was a sort of leading naval commander. And it put to sea, but the weather was clearly extremely bad, and the crew were very unhappy. And when the royal officials came to take the muster, there was a sort of semi-mutiny where they attacked the officials and threw the muster rolls in the sea and, you know, refused to let the muster be taken. And in fact, they some of the crew were put ashore on the Isle of Wight, you know. So you have a clear idea of the size of crew. You haven't got all the names because, of course, the muster rolls have been thrown in the sea. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it had a large crew, and it had a very experienced captain who was a man called Jordan Browning, who'd been a royal captain, sea captain, for some time. The precise number, I think the Grastia had about 200, crew of about 200.
Right, okay, a lot for the time, huh?
Which is, you know, very considerable. The Jesus, which was the next largest of these ships, had a crew about 139 to 200, but I think nearer 139. To handle the sails, you would have needed a lot of manpower. And of course, they weren't clearly separated into seamen and marines. They were expected to fight. Mm-hmm. And hand to hand, you needed a large...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Crew. So, I mean, we know exactly how the Grastia was equipped because there is in existence the infantry of the Grastia, which goes into considerable detail, not only of the actual things like the sails and the ropes and that. It also gives you a pretty good idea of the armaments on board. That's how you know that, in fact, it had, let's see, it had guns. It had three guns.
Fantastic, isn't it? The size of HMS Victory has three guns.
Three guns. Right, three guns with three chambers. You know that they didn't. They had to be muzzle loading as a way. Well, jolly difficult to muzzle load a gun you've got on the deck of a ship. Oh, yeah. But they would have, as it were, sort of packs of ready fire, gunpowder and balls, which they could attach in the chamber.
Right, okay.
And not have to lean over the rails, shoving balls up the
dangerous stuff.
Yes, I mean, and it had when you get down to sort of the smaller things, it gives you some idea of the sanitary arrangements. There were things called ship vats. Well, they were called sket vats, but I mean, I think they were ship vats.
Right. Okay.
So, and also they had. You get a pretty good idea of the rigging, the names of the, they supplied cordage by weight, as well as by length, but mainly it was by weight, Some of the cordage on a ship, like the Grastia, one's still not quite sure how it was set up because the terms have not really been elucidated properly.
No. How was this, I mean, in terms of how sea power was used and wielded at this time, how was that kind of conceived?
It's hard to be sure, really, because... documents that you have a lot of financial documents. How much did it cost to buy this, that, and the other thing? And I mean, and they kept meticulous accounts of things, what had been as it had been worn out or used up and had to be replaced, and. I mean, with Soper's accounts in general, long after all the ships had been sold or dispersed, in other words, he was sitting in Southampton with a storehouse full of odds and sods, you know,
yeah.
Which was all listed carefully.
So difficult to know. But they're royal ships, so it is a royal navy. They're not they're not wielding sea power by renting in private vessels.
Well, again, be careful because when opportunity served, not William Soper, but because strategic situation in the Channel was rather different, but his predecessor, who was a man called William Catton, when things were quite quieter before Agincourt, but Henry V had already begun to build up the number of ships in royal ownership, he rented them out to go on trading voyages. He rented them out to Italian merchants and he rented them out to English merchants, mainly to go to Bordeaux for wine.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one of the things about the ships that's important is that they were the king's personal property. They weren't a crown property as we would think about it. They were as much the king's personal property as Sandringham is the Queen's personal property. So that when Henry V died, his will contained the provision that all the ships should be sold. And most of them were, because that was the terms of the will. And of course, the Henry VI government was completely... you know, cash strapped. It hardly had, you know, sixpence to run to get rub to get to two sixpences to rub together. But so the Genoese had been driven out the Channel. Henry VI was King of France. What did you want all these expensive ships sitting in Southampton or the Hamble River eating money? You know, that was how it was probably seen.
So what happened to the Grastia?
The Grastia was clearly a bit special. The Trinity Royal and the Holy Ghost were sold. The Jesus was also sold. But the Grastia was never put up for sale. It stayed in Southampton, not for a while, and then it was taken down to the Hamble River to Basildon. And first of all, it was anchored off Basildon in the river. And then it was beached on the mudflats. And if you go there, above the modern road bridge, where there's a country park, and it's either the autumn equinox or the spring equinox. In fact, last week you could have done this. At the lowest of the low spring tides, you can see the ribs sticking up out of the mud.
Amazing. Still there after
still
all these
there.
Years.
Still there. It was beached there in the 1830s, and then it was struck by lightning and burnt to the waterline. Or at least it was. That's what they said in the accounts.
And then it's several generations until there's another naval, well, how should I put this, a monarchy with that interest and that kind of power in the navy.
Well, I mean, you know, there was no clerk of the king's ships. There were no royal ships from about, I think, the last one was called the Little Jesus or the Petit Jesus. In the 1430s, until Henry VII built Regent and Sovereign.
Yeah, that's because he's terrified that someone's going to pinch his crown just like he's pinched it already.
Yes. I mean, what they did was they hired, the guy who had the best ships was the Howards, you know, the Norfolks. And he built a couple of carracks on the east coast in Dunwich and Orwell, which were sent up to Scotland, you know, to fight there.
Interesting, though, that, you know, the Tudors essentially invade by sea, don't they? And
yeah,
that's how they come in boats. And then it's Henry VII and Henry VIII who build up the Tudor fleet. And there's this big kind of burgeoning of English sea.
I mean, Henry VII, I mean, there was the Swiftsure and the Regent and the Sovereign. And then, you know, Henry V really begins to expand the navy until it was capable of fighting the French off Brittany, you know, in the battle off Brest in the 1512 war.
Makes you wonder how much Henry VII and Henry VIII knew about the sort of ancestry of the navy. I mean, I'm assuming that the Grasshopper was still there and perfectly visible to them.
Well, it would have been a wreck.
But at least evidence of immense royal power invested in the sea.
There were all sorts of stories about the wreck. I mean, the usual one, it was a Viking ship.
Oh, right, very good. Yeah.
Which turned up in the gentlemen's magazines sometime in the 19th century.
Yeah.
So
it's a different question, isn't it? So A, what did the Tudors think of it? And then B, what did everyone else think of it?
And then, I mean, being absolutely sure what it was there was an attempt to excavate it in the very end of the 19th century, which caused some damage because they went and tried to blow it up a bit to get...
Excavation with dynamite.
Yes,
oh, good Lord.
But then in the 1930s, I mean, George Naish,
and we've gone full circle here.
Yes. Well, he must have been, I think he was a sort of young, I think he was in the Navy, I think he was a young naval officer when this happened. But he and someone called Michael Prynne, who was in the army, and I think George Naish's dad, did an excavation in the Hamble River and really got quite a lot of info. And they recovered timbers, some of which were in the museum at Winchester, but I don't know what's happened to them now. Mm. I mean, in Butler's Hard, there's one of the, in the little museum there used to be in Butler's Hard, there's a few spikes and things. And now, of course, it belongs, the wreck belongs to the Department of Archaeology at Southampton. They did make an attempt to try and use a sort of new idea, which was like a kind of a bottomless boat right. and do an underwater excavation.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But the water is so dirty. I mean, it's not dirty dirty, it's muddy dirty. The visibility was so poor, they couldn't see anything. And this that was put in one of the time team on Channel 4.
I think I've seen that one.
Yes, yeah. But I mean, it wasn't... in time team's terms, it was a terrible failure because they couldn't get, you know, it didn't work, this sort of underwater idea. And
do we know where she was built exactly?
Where she was built? Yeah. No, we don't. She was built in Southampton, probably up the Itchen.
Yeah.
But the site of a shipbuilding yard, I mean, the whole Southampton waterfront has been so, so altered, that the chances of ever identifying it as zilch. The time team people tried to find the site where the Pity Jesus, the last royal ship, was built at Burselden. And they did an excavation in someone's garden and that. And they did find a couple of ship nails.
Okay.
So, but yeah. The answer is we don't know where it was. It was in Southampton, not in Burselden. I mean, the Jesus was built up the Rother at Newhythe, you know, and brought down the river to Winchelsea. And the Trinity Royal was built at Deptford, and the Holy Ghost was a Spanish ship, which was more or less complete, a captured Spanish ship. It was refurbished in Southampton. But, the whole shipbuilding thing at Southampton, it wasn't just the Grastia. They, at the same time, they built two Ballingers, the small, swift, dual-powered oared and sailed ships at the same time, like a kind of squadron.
Mm.
They called the Swan and the Valentine. So it was a bit like a modern aircraft carrier. You have to have destroyers to protect it. You know, the Grastia had Ballingers.
Yeah. Satellite ships.
Satellite, yes.
Yeah, basically.
Yes.
Well, it's been wonderful hearing all about this ship. Thank you very much indeed, Elliot. Very many thanks for listening. Now, please, please don't just leave your important work with our podcast here. Please check out the Mariner's Mirror podcast's YouTube channel, where you will find some really extraordinary things to watch. Animated 3D models of ships, artificial intelligence bringing ships' figureheads to life, animated battle plans, the world's best ship models filmed with the very latest camera technology. The list goes on and on. This podcast comes from both the Lloyd's Register Foundation and the Society for Nautical Research. So do please check out both of those wonderful institutions. The archive of the Lloyd's Register Foundation can be found at hec.lrfoundation.org.uk and the Society for Nautical Research at snr.org.uk, where you can join up. Yes, there is a free level of membership. I would urge you to sign up to that, but just for a little bit of money. You get 4 copies a year of the Mariner's Mirror Journal, access to online and in-person events. You become part of a wonderful community, a society that has been helping to preserve maritime history and heritage for over a century. It really is a fabulous way to spend a little bit of money. You even get to come to dinner on board HMS Victory, and for someone interested in maritime and naval history, there's nothing better than that.